When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, Talia.
Hi, Tanya.
How are you today?
Today's a great day. I would ask how you are, but I know.
Let's just move on.
Yeah, we're just going to move on. I already know.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crimes and Consequences. Before I tell you this week's episode, I would just like to remind you to please hit the subscribe or follow button on whatever app you're listening to us on.
Sounds good.
All right. On Thursday, August 18th, 2005, a woman named Sharon Cave and her boyfriend, Jim Sedwick, drove to Austin, Texas from their home in Corpus Christi, Texas, to look for Sharon's daughter. Her daughter was Jennifer. Jennifer was 21, and she'd been living in Austin for about 2 years.
I heard Austin is a fun town.
I've heard that too. I've never visited.
Me either.
Someday. Sharon and Jennifer were very close, and they spoke to each other by phone pretty much every day, sometimes several times a day. A few days earlier, on Monday, August 15th, Jennifer had told her mom that she was interviewing for a new job at a law firm in Austin.
Don't do it.
Later that day, Jennifer called her mom again and said, I got the job. And she was so excited.
To work at a law firm?
Yeah, apparently. Well, not as a lawyer.
Been there, done that. It's not that exciting.
So, I mean, she couldn't contain her excitement. That's how excited she was.
Yeah, I can imagine. She's 21, right?
Yeah, exactly. She was going to start her new job the next day, Tuesday, August 16th.
Literally the next day?
Mm-hmm, the next day, because she wasn't working at the time, and so she was happy to get this new job. However, on Wednesday, August 16th, so this is the day after her first day of work, so second day of work, Sharon got a phone call from Jennifer's new boss, William Thompson, who was one of the attorneys at the law firm. William asked Sharon if she'd spoken to Jennifer that day, and Sharon said, no, I haven't heard from her. Jennifer didn't come into work that day.
Her second day?
Right.
Oh, that's bad.
Which seems really unusual considering how excited she was. Jennifer also wasn't answering her phone. The law firm had also sent someone over to Jennifer's apartment to check on her, but there was no answer.
Wow, they did all that?
Yes, isn't that nice?
I just assumed that she thought the job sucked.
Right.
And didn't want to come back. That's what I would assume, but.
that's funny. Sharon immediately began calling Jennifer's cell phone, but all of her calls went straight to voicemail. Believing maybe that Jennifer had just misplaced her phone, Sharon still was a little worried in the back of her mind. So she called Jennifer's cell phone provider. From that company, she obtained a list of the numbers that had called or been called from Jennifer's phone, starting with Jennifer's last call at 1:08 a.m. on Wednesday. And it went back several hours.
She must have been the owner
That's
of the
I'm
account,
because
otherwise you can't get that.
Because it's super easy, right? She got it right away. Sharon began calling the numbers that appeared on the list that were there like more frequently, hoping to find someone who might know where Jennifer was. So that next day that I started our story on is Thursday, August 18th. So Sharon's making these calls and she does get a hold of a few of Jennifer's friends, and I'll get into that in a minute. But I'm just jumping forward to the next day that I started our story on, Thursday, the 18th. Sharon and Jim decided to call the Austin police, and they spoke to a woman named Detective Kathleen Hector, and she was in the missing persons office. Sharon told Detective Hector all that had happened the previous day, all the phone calls she made, including Jennifer's failure to appear for work, and everything else she did to try to find Jennifer. Sharon also gave the detective the names and numbers of the people she had called. Detective Hector assured Sharon that the police would check it out and would look for her license and see if there was anything, like if her car came up, like it got impounded or anything,
or
like that.
Or she's been arrested, right, or anything like that.
Right. That's when Sharon and Jim decided, we have to do something and we can't wait. And now they're headed to Austin.
They were really worried.
They were really worried. They left Corpus Christi at 11 a.m. on Thursday morning. When they were near San Antonio, Detective Hector called Sharon on her cell phone to tell her that Jennifer's car had been found at 2529 Rio Grande near the University of Texas campus. Detective Hector told Sharon that a man named Colton Petoniak lived at that address in apartment 88. Sharon knew Colton. He was one of Jennifer's friends. He was also one of the people Sharon had called on Wednesday. In addition to Colton, Sharon had called a man named Michael Rodriguez. Michael spoke to Jennifer by phone three times on Tuesday night the 16th and going into Wednesday morning the 17th. Jennifer told Michael she was going to hang out with Colton, who Michael didn't know, so they weren't mutual friends. In a second call around midnight, Jennifer said that Colton was quote-unquote upset. In the third call at 1 a.m., Jennifer told Michael that Colton was upset because he had lost his cell phone, that he had tried to break out a window of a parked car, and that he was, at that moment, urinating on another vehicle.
Oh, shit.
It's going down.
He's fucking drunk.
Things got crazy.
That's the shit you do when you're drunk.
Exactly.
Or on drugs.
Or both.
Or both.
Michael told Sharon that Jennifer didn't sound like she was in any trouble or anything like that. And he just assumed Colton was, like you said, drunk and just doing stupid shit. While Sharon was speaking to Michael, Colton, who she had also been attempting to reach, called on her cell phone. So she's talking to Michael on her work phone, and Colton's now on the cell phone.
And this is the mom.
This is the mom. So she puts Michael, you know, can you please hold? And she asks Colton if he's seen Jennifer, if he's talked to her, and he said no. She goes back to Michael. Michael said, well, that's not true. She was with him that night because she told me.
And she's like, hold on one second.
Hold on one second. She goes back to Colton and said that I'm on the phone with somebody that says that she was with you. Colton then admitted he had seen Jennifer downtown, but claimed he didn't know where she was now. And Michael was still on the phone. And he says to Sharon, Colton's lying. He was with her last night. He's completely lying to you.
And this is based on what he heard from Jennifer on the phone?
Yes. After talking to Michael and Colton at Wednesday, Sharon began to call places in Austin like hospitals and the morgue. And, you know, she called, right, and she called Detective Hector. And she didn't find Jennifer, obviously. So she decides, okay, now I need to really file a missing persons report. Initially, Austin police said that Jennifer hadn't been missing long enough to file the missing persons report. He did open a file and he gave Sharon the number. And I think that's when Detective Hector called her and said, we're going to try and find her for you. By this time, it was about 5 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon, after she gets off the phone and does all this talking. And she calls Jim. She's like, there's something really wrong. There's something wrong with Jennifer. I don't get a good feeling. And they decide to drive to Austin. Jim tried to call Colton, but he didn't answer. So Jim left a quote unquote stern message telling him to call back and that they were looking for Jennifer. At about 7:30, so a couple hours later, Colton returned the call. Sharon pleaded with him saying, please, please, do you know anything? And he said to her, quote, dude, I'm eating pizza with my friends. Leave me alone. I don't know where she's at. And he hung up on her.
Nice.
Right.
Little asshole.
Exactly. So now you fully understand why Jim and Sharon felt the need to drive to Austin that Thursday.
I can't believe that he is busy eating pizza
with his friends
and can't talk.
Can't tell you. I don't know where she's at.
About basically, their missing daughter.
Basically giving her the finger, right? Jim and Sharon got to Austin about 4 p.m. that Thursday, and they immediately drove to Colton's address, the one that Detective Hector had given to Sharon. They were met there by Sharon's daughter, Vanessa, who had also driven to Austin from her home in Dallas to help look for her sister. Where the apartment slash condo was, it's a huge condominium complex called the Orange Tree. So I may refer to it as the Orange Tree. They did find Jennifer's car parked in the street, and Colton's apartment was on the second floor. Detective Hector's business card was on the car and on Colton's apartment door. Sharon didn't really find anything out of the ordinary, like in the parking lot, in the car, at the door. They knocked on the door and the windows, and they were calling out Jennifer's name, but there wasn't any response.
Wow, Sharon and Jim are doing all of this?
Yes.
Good for them.
I know. After about an hour, they left the Orange Tree, and they went to a hotel. Sharon, who had a spare key to Jennifer's car, drove Jennifer's car to the hotel, and she was hoping that if maybe Jennifer came out of the apartment and saw that her car was missing, the first thing she would do would be to call the police and, you know, we could solve this mystery. While at the hotel, Sharon decided to call directory assistance in Arkansas. She had learned during telephone conversation with one of Jennifer's friends that Colton was from Arkansas, and she had seen a car with Arkansas license plates at the Orange Tree. Sharon managed to get a hold of Colton's dad.
Oh, damn.
I know.
Good for her.
She really should join the police force. She's an awesome detective, right?
That's amazing.
She told his dad that her daughter was missing and she was looking for her. Colton had been the last person that they thought that she was with the night of Tuesday the 16th. Colton's dad told her that Colton had called them, his parents in Arkansas, and asked if he could take Jennifer to dinner and use his mom's credit card that night. So he confirmed that Jennifer and Colton were together somewhere Tuesday night. So Jim and Sharon are at the hotel and they decide, okay, we need to go back to the Orange Tree.
I would be stalking him.
I know, right?
Just waiting.
Fearing that she made a mistake by moving Jennifer's car, Sharon drove it back and parked it where she found it.
I don't know if that really fixes it once you've moved it.
I know. I know. She's like, oh, shit, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Joined by Vanessa and one of Vanessa's friends, and Vanessa's Jennifer's sister, if you remember.
Is she older or younger?
She's older. Sharon and Jim again knocked on Colton's door but got no response. Although Sharon had been told by Detective Hector that there was nothing that the police could do at this time, she still called the police again, and Officer Guillermo Salinas was dispatched to the Orange Tree. Officer Salinas arrived at 8:36 p.m. Sharon filled him in on all the details of Jennifer's disappearance and her fear that she might be in apartment 88. Officer Salinas examined Jennifer's car and Colton's, and he confirmed that it was Colton's, the one with the Arkansas license plate. And he knocked on the apartment door with no answer. Officer Salinas spoke to someone at the complex who told him that the apartments were actually individually owned condominiums, and there was no building manager who could let them in, like, with a master key.
They're like site condos?
Right. Probably. After Officer Salinas consulted with his superiors by radio, he told Sharon and Jim that he wasn't allowed to use force to get into the apartment. Jim asked him, well, what would happen if I forced the entry of the apartment?
Oh, shit.
I know.
I'm going to fall in love with him if he does that, because that is badass.
I know. Officer Salinas is like, well, if you broke in, you could possibly be charged with criminal trespass. Jim then asked Officer Salinas if the police were willing to enter the apartment if Jim hired a locksmith to open the door.
What? Jim?
I know.
You can't just hire a locksmith to open someone's door and then once it's open, call the police and be like, it's open.
It's open. Check it out.
Though, I mean, I got to give him credit for being creative.
I know. Officer Salinas again checked with his supervisor and said, no, you can't do that. Then Officer Salinas left around approximately 45 minutes after he got there. After the officer left, Sharon and Jim were desperate. They didn't know what to do next. The police were telling them, you know, sorry, but we can't help you right now. Sharon had this nagging feeling that she just had to get into Colton's apartment because it's the only place she thought Jennifer could be.
But if Colton's car is there, aren't they concerned that he's in there?
I don't think they care at this point.
Okay.
I think they're just worried about Jennifer.
And they'll deal with the consequences afterwards.
Exactly. Because Colton seemed to be the last person to be with Jennifer before she disappeared, So if he's in the apartment, great, but something's going on and he's the missing link to their answers. Sharon and Jim decided to call a locksmith.
They did. No way.
Mm-hmm. And the locksmith came out and attempted to open the door.
What?
I know,
right? Can he do that?
He did, but he didn't get in.
Okay. I mean, aren't there some rules?
I would like think show there's ownership rules. Yes, of something. You're breaking into someone's house. Like, I don't know why the locksmith should have checked. Like, can I see that you live here?
I'm not blaming him.
I'm not either. And
I appreciate his efforts.
As they stood outside of Colton's apartment after the locksmith left, Sharon noticed that one of the windows was cracked. She went over with her fingernail and she started chipping on the glass a little bit of the cracked window. She ended up making a little hole in the window pane.
How convenient.
I know. So she used a piece from a broken pair of sunglasses, like the arm, to open the lock. So Jim opened the window and he climbed in the apartment.
Damn. I am just stunned. Yes. By this. They are so awesome.
Aren't they awesome?
They really are. They should have their own detective show.
They really should have their own detective show. I would tune in.
Right.
Before I tell you what Jim found in the apartment, we're going to take a break.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
As Jim entered the apartment through the window, he kept calling out things like, I'm here to help. Please don't hurt me. Please don't shoot me. I'm looking for Jennifer. No one was there, though. No one was answering him, and it was quiet. He had a flashlight that he kept in his car, so he had brought that into the apartment with him. He began to look around the small apartment. He said the room was just in complete disarray, kind of like one you would see for college students. There was no one on the couch, in the bed, or in the kitchen area, like the bed in the bedroom. And in that area, though, he found a light switch and he turned it on. When he turned on the light, he said at that point he smelled something.
And what room is he in?
He's in the kitchen area. He followed the smell and walked down a short hallway to the bathroom.
Oh, that's not good.
No.
Following a smell.
I know. He opened the bathroom door and the smell just smacked him in the face.
Oh, no.
He pointed the flashlight to the bathtub area and he saw something. He was trying to wrap his mind around what he was actually seeing. He turned on the light. And what he ended up seeing was a decapitated body in the bathtub.
A body without a head?
A body without a head.
In Colton's condo?
Yes, in Colton's condo. And no one else is there.
Isn't he like a college student?
Yes, he's a college student.
Just an ordinary college student in Austin, Texas with a headless corpse?
Yes.
In his bathtub?
Yes.
Holy shit.
At that point... I know, right? How terrifying. I mean, how fucking Jesus. Terrifying. I'm sure that's the last thing he thought he would have seen in there.
God, I can't even.
I know. He yelled to Sharon to call the police, like, call 911. It's serious.
Fuck yeah, it is.
He also noticed a hacksaw on the bathroom floor. He went to the front door and he unlocked it and went back outside. Sharon was yelling to him because he wouldn't let Sharon in.
Well, thank God.
I know. She's yelling to him, is it her? Is it Jennifer? Is it her? And Jim said, I think so.
Oh, my God.
I know.
As a mom, I would be like, you think so? Like, what's exactly that mean?
And that's what she was basically thinking in her head. And she's trying to get into the apartment. Jim stopped her. He just kept telling her, you can't. You can't. No, 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 no. You can't go in there. Outside the apartment, Vanessa had called 911 and was on the phone with the operator. Jim spoke to the operator and he told them there was a body in the bathtub. The bathtub was filled with blood and that they needed to send someone over immediately.
Hell yeah. Yes.
Yes. After hanging up with 911, Jim went back into the apartment and went back to the bathroom. God
no,
bless him. Yes.
No.
I know. And it was because he was unsure if it was Jennifer.
I mean, I know. I'm just saying, at that point, let the police, I mean.
He had to know. The body was wearing a greenish dress that he thought he recognized.
Oh.
And going back outside, Sharon repeatedly was asking him if it was Jennifer. Is it her? Is it her? And he told her, I think so. I saw her feet.
I saw her feet? What?
Jennifer had freckles on her feet, and he recognized them.
Oh, jeez. This is insane.
I know. And in addition to being decapitated, the body was also missing hands.
Hmm. What?
Yeah, I didn't tell you that part, but, you know, identifying information, right? Two officers show up to the condo complex, and they went to apartment 8 instead of 88. They thought they were responding to a call of a possible overdose. So they get to apartment 8, she's like, no. The apartment owner's like, no.
No, I'm
no,
good.
There's nobody here.
We're fine.
And while they're talking to the woman at apartment 8, they notice ambulances showing up. So like, oh shit, we're in the wrong place. So they get over to apartment 88. The officers were Officer Clark and Officer Babaria. So they go to the correct apartment. Again, still, they think they're responding to an overdose. And when Officer Babaria shows up, Jim approaches him. Jim told him, the woman inside the apartment is dead. So it's not an overdose.
No.
Officer Babaria entered the apartment following a group of firefighters. And they went inside the bathroom. The firefighters went first. Officer Babaria had responded to overdoses before. So the typical procedure would be that the firefighters would go in first. And he would be looking around the apartment for like paraphernalia or drugs or things like that.
So they're going to do more EMT kind of stuff and he's going to do more investigating.
Yes. So as soon as the firefighters got into the bathroom, though, they turned around and they were leaving the apartment and Officer Babaria was like, what's going on? So he peeks in and he notices the body in the tub.
I'd be getting the fuck out of Dodge too.
Right, exactly.
I mean, they don't get paid enough for
oh my
this
God.
Stuff.
Officer Babaria said that the body was propped up in the bathtub facing the doorway. He did see the hacksaw and that was actually on the body's chest. It was on her body. And he saw what he said were portions of flesh and blood on the hacksaw. So he, of course, thought, well, this must have been the hacksaw that was used to decapitate and remove the hands. And that's when he notices a plastic garbage bag on the bathroom floor. He didn't look inside of it because he just knew. Based on the shape of the bag, he knew the head and the hands had to be in there.
Oh, that's weird.
I know.
Why? Cut them off just to leave them in the bathroom.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Oh.
After making sure no one else was in the apartment, officers Babaria and Clark closed the apartment and they contacted homicide detectives. The body in Colton's bathtub was positively identified as Jennifer Cave. As Officer Babaria had suspected, Jennifer's severed head and hands were in the plastic bag. It was determined during her autopsy that Jennifer was killed by a single gunshot. The bullet passed through her right arm and re-entered her body through the ribs on her right side. The bullet then passed through her right lung and punctured the aorta, which caused her death.
So she was shot to death?
Yes.
And on the side? Like, if you're going to kill somebody, why are you shooting them on the side?
I know, it's bizarre, right?
Unless it was I don't know, some sort of recklessness.
I know. It doesn't seem like...
I mean, if I'm going to kill somebody, I'm going to go for, like, the head or the heart.
Yeah, from the front.
Right.
The bullet was found in her body just under her skin on the left side of her back. In addition to the bullet wound, there were numerous stab wounds on her body.
Was she stabbed while she was still alive?
No, there were 18 stab wounds on her face and neck, and another cluster of 10 stab wounds on her left shoulder and right breast. And as I said, all of them were inflicted after death.
18 on her face and neck?
Mm-hmm.
That seems very, really personal.
It does seem personal, doesn't it?
Like you're trying to destroy her identity.
Mm-hmm. Weirdly enough, a second bullet was found in Jennifer's head when the body was x-rayed. And it was determined that the head wound was also inflicted post-mortem.
So once she was dead, they shot her in the head?
Yes. Once she was decapitated, they shot her in the head.
What?
Because the bullet had entered through the severed neck and traveled upward, lodging into her skull. Yeah, they found an upward trajectory, so...
Wow, that's just so weird.
Very, very strange. The two bullets found in her body were fired from a .380 semi-automatic pistol that was found in Colton's car. Three cartridge casings fired from that pistol were found in the apartment, but the third bullet was never found. So three shots were fired, but that third bullet was never found.
Well, that's weird. Where would it be?
I don't know. In addition to the bloody hacksaw found on Jennifer's body, a knife and a machete stained with Jennifer's blood were found in Colton's apartment. A warrant to search Colton's apartment was issued at 4:40 a.m. on Friday morning, about 6 hours after her body was discovered. When they searched his apartment, they did find the bloody knife and machete in the dishwasher.
In the dishwasher?
Yes.
What?
I know.
What?
And you're not there. Like, way to leave all the evidence behind.
Right.
It just makes no sense. Not that the murder makes sense, but the whole thing just seems...
Like you're trying to clean up, but then you just stop.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, fuck it.
Fuck it. During the last evening of Jennifer's life, she and Colton had gone to a bar in downtown Austin to celebrate her new job.
Were they dating?
No, they were just friends. Witnesses who saw them together said Jennifer didn't appear to be drunk or intoxicated, but Colton appeared to be under the influence of either alcohol or drugs.
Yeah, he was pissing on a car, right?
Exactly. And two witnesses said he mentioned buying some coke.
Oh, shit. Party.
Right. Jennifer and Colton's relationship started 2 years earlier. So I'll give you a little background. Colton had been going to the University of Texas, but he got suspended permanently. I guess it was expelled. After he got deeply involved with drugs.
Permanently?
Mm-hmm. And at the time when he and Jennifer met, he was attending the community college. So around the time that they meet, Jennifer was also struggling with drug addiction. Sharon and her mom had noticed some warning signs, but Jennifer assured her that she was okay. But unfortunately, Jennifer went into a downward spiral when her boyfriend Mark broke up with her. She ended up showing up to work high, and she was fired.
Ah, yeah.
And she worked at a high-end steakhouse.
Oh.
One of those real fancy places. Colton and Jennifer met at a party, and they hit it off. Colton supposedly had a huge crush on Jennifer, but it wasn't reciprocated, so they remained friends. Colton would give her drugs, and she would spend time with him. So that was the exchange. At the end of 2004, Jennifer had started dating a guy named Scott who was a single dad. He helped her get clean, and he told her, drugs are not allowed around my daughter, and that if Jennifer wanted the relationship to work, she had to quit using. By the beginning of 2005, Jennifer had tried to break most of the ties she had with Colton, and she was working on her sobriety. Around the same time, Colton started dating a would-be attorney. She was hoping to take the LSAT. Her name was Laura Hall. Laura was infatuated with Colton.
Who has a crush on Jennifer.
Yes. And during their friendship relationship, I think they were more than friends. I think Laura thought they were in a relationship, but I think Colton saw her as a booty call.
Oh, that's hurtful.
Yes. While they're together, Colton gets Laura hooked on drugs.
That's not very nice.
No. Laura also hated Jennifer. She was jealous of the friendship that Colton and Jennifer shared, and she believed Jennifer was her rival for Colton's affections. even though Jennifer was seeing Scott and really had no interest in Colton that way. But in Laura's mind, it was the complete opposite. About 6 months later, Colton still had a thin hold on Jennifer, so I'm thinking this is maybe around June or July, and she was murdered in August. He was really manipulative, and he would call her all the time. Jennifer was a really kind woman, and she had a soft spot for those she cared about, so she would always help Colton or be someone to be on the other end of the phone if he needed someone to talk to. Jennifer's relationship with Scott began to fall apart at this time because she wasn't sure if she was ready to have a family. She broke up with Scott, moved out of his house, moved in with a roommate that she had at the time of her death. Her roommate's name was Denise.
Her roommate's name. Hi, Denise.
Yeah. At this time, also, Jennifer looked for work, and she did finally get clean. But it was short-lived. She started hanging out with Colton more and more again and started using. After Jennifer's body was found, the investigation into her murder began. The owner of a hardware store a few blocks from Colton's apartment told police that Colton was in the store shortly after 3 p.m. on Wednesday afternoon.
So that's the morning after they went out.
Yes. He bought a hacksaw.
Oh.
Shop towels. Latex gloves. Dust masks. 55-gallon drum liners. Ammonia. Carpet cleaner. And odor eliminator.
Oh.
Colton told the owner when he inquired, what are you going to use that hacksaw for? Oh, I'm just cutting up a turkey.
What? I know. And he's got a hacksaw, latex gloves, a mask.
Some ammonia.
Garbage bags.
Yes.
What? See, you and I would know.
Right.
We were calling the police.
This owner of this hardware store obviously doesn't watch true crime.
And then he says he's cutting up
a turkey
with a hacksaw?
Yeah, you don't have a sharp knife at home?
Good Thanksgiving. I never even thought of that. Honey, can you go get the hacksaw for the turkey? What?
For real.
Oh, so weird.
I think you could find something a little smaller than a hacksaw.
So strange.
But the owner was like, okay.
I mean, what's he going to do?
Right. After leaving the hardware store, Colton stopped at a Burger King and got a hamburger, fries, and a drink. The remains of the meal were found by the police in Colton's apartment. Stop for a snack.
That's just so sick.
I know. What the hell? Jennifer's former boyfriend, Scott, was interviewed by police, and he told him he and Jennifer lived together for several months in early 2005, and they had remained friends after Jennifer moved out. Through Jennifer, Scott was acquainted with Colton. On Wednesday afternoon, August 17th, Sharon called Scott on the phone. That was one of the calls she had made, and told him Jennifer was missing and that she had last been seen with Colton. After talking to Sharon, Scott called Colton and left a message. Colton returned the call within 15 minutes, and he told Scott that he hadn't seen Jennifer since having dinner with her on Tuesday night. Scott told Colton that Jennifer's car was parked at his apartment, and that more than likely the cops are going to show up because she's missing and her car is at your apartment. Colton replied, quote, "That bitch is going to get me arrested," end quote.
God, I hate him.
I know. What a turd.
That bitch is going to get me arrested?
That bitch is going to get me arrested. That Wednesday night, Colton left Austin. So he's not at his place when, obviously, Sharon and Jim get there. He left with Laura Hall in her car. They drove to the border of Mexico, and they made their way into Piedras Negras. They checked into a motel in that city on Friday, August 19th. They ended up being arrested at that motel by Mexican police 4 days later and turned over to U.S. Marshals. When Marshal Vincent Bellino told Colton he was being arrested for murder, he said, "If this is a murder charge, then I know exactly what this is about."
Well, I would hope so.
I know, what the hell?
I would hope so. Clearly the kid's a genius.
Tell me about it. Laura would later say those 5 days she spent with Colton in Mexico were the best days of her life.
Oh, stop it.
She ended up being arrested in September. Colton was eventually tried for Jennifer's murder, and he testified on his own behalf. Mm. I love when they testify on their own behalf. He gave a little background of himself. He said he graduated from high school in Little Rock, Arkansas in 2001. In the fall, he entered the University of Texas on an academic scholarship. He did well at first, but he began taking drugs and drinking to excess. He was arrested for driving while intoxicated in December 2002 and that's when he got suspended from the university. For the next 2.5 years, he was in and out of school, and he continued to drink heavily and use drugs, and rarely went to class. So his academic career is going like shit.
And who owns that condo he's living in?
I don't know. I never found out who owned the condo. So that fall, he was arrested for possession of cocaine as part of an agreement by which the offense was reduced to a misdemeanor. Colton entered a residential drug rehab center. He was released after 1 month, and he began using drugs and drinking 2 days later. It was about this time that he met Laura Hall. Laura would come to his apartment, and they would stay up drinking and doing drugs together. He said Laura was in love with him, but he didn't share those feelings. During the summer of 2005, he was drinking a case of beer and a liter of vodka every day.
God damn!
I know, that's a lot, right?
Holy shit!
A liter of vodka? Ooh, my liver hurts just thinking about it.
That's like 24 fucking beers, man. I know.
In addition to the drinking, he was taking Xanax and using cocaine.
Oh, fuck. Wow, that puts anything I did in college to shame.
He was also buying and selling coke and other drugs. He did admit to that on the stand. In July 2005, he was given the .380 pistol that I told you killed Jennifer. The guy who gave it to him was just some guy that owed him money for drugs. That person also gave him a box of ammunition. He never loaded the weapon, and he threw out the ammo, or so he says. In August, he sold the pistol without the ammunition to a friend of Laura's named Jason. A few days later, after he sold it, Jason visited Colton at his apartment. He asked to borrow Colton's car and offered to leave the pistol with him as an assurance that he would return it. So Colton agreed, and that's how the pistol became in Colton's possession again. On Tuesday night, August 16th, Jennifer called Colton about 9 p.m., and she told him about the new job she got. She was really excited, and she was wanting to catch him up on things that were happening.
Is that when they went out for dinner?
Mm-hmm. She said, do you want to go out downtown? We'll get drinks. We'll have something to eat. So Colton said, yeah, if you come pick me up, I'll go with you. He had been drinking vodka steadily since about 5 p.m., so at least 4 hours, and he had also taken several Xanax. He recalled going to the restaurant with Jennifer where he bought a drink, but he said that was the last thing he remembered about that night. The next memory he had was waking up in his apartment the following morning. Telephone records showed that Colton made several calls between 5:30 and 6 a.m. Wednesday morning, but he couldn't remember whether he made the calls before or after he discovered Jennifer's body. Sometime that morning, he went to the bathroom to use it, and that's when he saw her lying in the tub. He knew when he saw her that Jennifer was dead. At this point, she's fully intact still. Asked why he didn't call the police, he said he was just scared, he didn't know what happened, he didn't know what to do, and he panicked. Despite having no recollection of it, Colton was certain that he was the one that shot Jennifer. He felt this way because he said everything points to that.
And he admitted this on the stand?
Yes, and he admitted this on the stand because he couldn't think of any other thing that had happened. They were the ones that were together alone in the apartment.
So Laura wasn't there?
No. He insisted, though, that there was no way he would have shot her on purpose. So he's probably blackout drunk. After he discovered the body, he called Laura and told her, don't come to my apartment, as she had planned to do, but she insisted on coming. When she got there at about 8 a.m., Colton showed her Jennifer's body. She asked him, well, so what are we going to do?
I would get the fuck out. That's what I would do.
Right? Let's make a plan.
There's no we in this.
No, there's no we. I'm getting the fuck out of here. They discussed the possibility of cutting up the body, asked why he would consider doing this. Colton said he wanted to get rid of the body. He didn't know what to do. That would not be my first.
I know. Like, why would that cross your mind?
Right?
That's horrible.
I know. He didn't remember personally cutting the body and also claimed he didn't see Laura cutting Jennifer's body. He did remember Laura telling him that what she was trying wasn't working and that she needed some things, which he assumed meant items to use to cut up Jennifer's body.
So Laura is the one?
Supposedly.
Disarticulating her?
Mm-hmm. Then Laura gave him a list of items to purchase at the hardware store. He knew the hacksaw and other supplies were used to cut up Jennifer's body. After returning to the apartment with the saw, He said, quote, I tried to go in there and do some cutting, but I couldn't, end quote. Colton was asked if he was the one that fired the shot into Jennifer's severed head. He said he didn't. Asked who he thought did it, he said, well, I wasn't there when it happened, but I can only assume it was Laura because she was the only other person present.
So where was he at?
I don't know where he was when it happened because he's going to the hardware store to buy a hacksaw, but the knife and the machete were already in the apartment, so it's possible that Laura had decapitated Jennifer before he went to the hardware store, and while he was gone, she shot Jennifer's head.
Why?
Because she's dead already. Jealous bitch.
But she's dead already.
I know. She just hated her. That's the only thing I can think of. She just hated her so much, and I don't know this. This wasn't in the court records, but I'm thinking she was the one doing all the stabbing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's what I'm just going to ask you. Because it's the face, you said, and the neck.
And her right breast, her neck, her chest, her face.
She just wanted to annihilate her.
Right. While on the stand, he did remember the telephone call from Sharon Cave on Wednesday and admitted he was rude to her. That night when Sharon told him that she had called the police, he panicked. He started throwing clothes in a bag and told Laura they needed to get out of the apartment. They needed to go somewhere to figure out what happened. They didn't have any definite plans when they left, but at some point they decided to go to Mexico. And that's how they ended up there. It was like on the fly. Who thinks of this?
It's like a movie, only real life.
At the conclusion of Colton's trial, he was convicted of Jennifer's murder. He was sentenced to 55 years in prison. He will be eligible for parole after he serves one half of his sentence. At that time, he will be about 51. In case you're wondering what happened to Miss Laura.
I absolutely am wondering what happened to that bitch.
This is going to piss you off.
Oh, jeez.
So everybody be prepared. She was convicted of tampering with evidence, dismembering Jennifer, which is the dismemberment of Jennifer. That's tampering with evidence. And hindering Colton's arrest by fleeing with him to Mexico.
Wouldn't that be mutilating a corpse?
That's not what she was convicted of.
Hmm.
She was sentenced to 5 years for tampering with evidence and 1 year for hindering Colton's arrest. The sentences were to be served concurrently. She appealed her sentence, and on February 19, 2009, the Texas Third Circuit of Appeals decided her sentence was unfair and ordered resentencing. While waiting for resentencing, Laura was allowed to be released on bond. So she's out at that time. In 2010, a jury resentenced her to the maximum sentence allowed, which was 10 years for tampering. I know, that's the only laugh in this. And 1 year for hindering Colton's arrest. The sentences, again, were to be served concurrently, and she got credit for the 2 years she had already served before her sentence was overturned.
What did she have to say about all this?
Laura pretty much maintained she was innocent for her part in the crime, saying she was at Colton's place the night of the murder, but Jennifer was already dead and she didn't help dismember the body. She didn't call the police, she said, because she was afraid of Colton.
But I thought she had the time of her life in Mexico with him.
I know, right? Laura petitioned for parole in 2011, 2014, and 2016. Obviously, those were denied. However, she was released from prison on March 15th, 2018, under mandatory supervision, GPS monitoring, and she wasn't allowed to return to Travis County, where this crime took place. She was also not allowed to make contact with Jennifer's family until the end of her prison sentence, which was in August 2018. So she's out.
I don't even know what to say about that girl. I do not know what to say about that.
I'm highly disturbed.
Yeah, that's just flat out fucking weird. I feel so bad for Jennifer Cave. Mm-hmm. I mean, do they know if that shot killed her instantly? Because of the way you...
I believe so, because it went to her heart.
Okay. I guess the saving grace is that most of the brutality that was done to her, she was already past.
That's true. That's true. I can only look at it, too, from Sharon's perspective.
Yeah.
That her poor daughter. Ugh, I can't imagine. It's just terrible. Colton filed an appeal, but it was denied. And I'm going to tell you a little story about his appellate attorney. His appellate attorney was Christopher Perry. He believed Laura killed Jennifer, not Colton. He believed that Laura killed her out of jealousy of the relationship that Jennifer and Colton had. Mr. Perry said Laura got the idea to dismember Jennifer's body after seeing an episode of The Sopranos in which a body was dismembered so police couldn't identify it. After trying to dismember Jennifer, Laura quit after realizing it was a monumental task and suggested to Colton that they flee to Mexico. Mr. Perry contends Laura was the one who fired the gun into Jennifer's dismembered head and did so just to make sure she was dead.
Well, if her neck is open.
He called her psychotic.
Well, okay, I could see that.
He was really upset that Colton's life was basically ruined over something he didn't think Colton did. He bases some of his suspicion on the fact that Laura told several coworkers about her involvement in Jennifer's death and that she said the worst thing about it was, quote, hearing the saw cut through bone.
Oh.
She bragged to another friend that she could tell her grandchildren that she cut up a body.
What?
Someday, yes. Colton's appeal was based on those witness statements, and Mr. Perry said the prosecution knew about them in his first trial but didn't share them with the defense, which is a serious violation of the Brady Disclosure Act that requires the prosecution to share their exculpatory evidence with the defense. Mr. Perry filed appeals to the Federal Fifth Circuit of Appeals that was denied in 2013. A second appeal was denied by the Texas Supreme Court. He filed a third appeal when he obtained new evidence, he said, of Laura's involvement, but that too was turned down because the court said it was redundant of his prior appeals.
What was the new evidence?
I don't know. I'll leave it with this. And this affected me because I think you and I, Talia, have been through this in our careers. Mr. Perry said that this case has jaded him about the criminal system. Everything points to Laura's guilt, and he feels that the trial was just a mockery of justice.
Were her fingerprints on the gun?
I never read anything in the court records about her fingerprints being on the gun, but that's a good question.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I got most of the information for this episode from the court records, but I did use also several articles that will be in the show notes. And I do want to give a shout out to the person who suggested this case, and that was Nicole S.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you, Nicole.
It was an awesome case.
Very awesome and disturbing case.
Aren't they all?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. You're right. I could use disturbing and sad.
For every single one we've ever done.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode. Again, I'm going to remind you to hit the subscribe or follow button on the apps that you listen to us on. If you're interested in finding out more, seeing some pictures about this episode, you can go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com. You can also follow us on social media at Hardcore True Crime on both Facebook and Instagram. If you're interested in merch, we have that on our website.
Yeah, check it out.
Check it out. There's some awesome Christmas stuff there.
We just did a shout out to Nicole, but we have other shout outs.
Yes, we do have other shout outs.
This is our way of saying thank you to those who
join Patreon.
Join Patreon or our Apple subscribers on our Apple channel.
Yes. Do you want to read the list or should I?
You can.
Okay. Hold your applause until the end.
I will.
We would like to thank Apple subscribers Jean, Shanna, Rachel, and Kathy H. We would also like to thank Dana, Maria S., Sierra, Yvette G., Jennifer R., Pam N., Lindsay S., Miranda Z., Lindsay and Dana, Sasha T., Christy Lee, or Christy Leah, Rachel, Jill N., Julie S., Michelle Z., Heather L., Carol W., Jennifer D., Brittany C., Angie J., and Amber.
Wow. Thank you guys all so much for supporting us. And for those that somehow don't know about our Patreon or Apple channel, you can get over 100 exclusive episodes only released to our subscribers. And you also get early releases and ad-free releases of our weekly episodes like this one right now.
So check it out.
So check it out.
Go to patreon.com/TNTCrimes or you can go to our website.
Or the Apple or Podcast.
Apple. Yeah, Apple Podcasts. If you're listening to us on Apple, you see us in the library. If you open up your library to listen to an episode, you can see the button to subscribe.
Why not? Do it.
But if you are an Apple subscriber, we don't get information on your name. So if you'd like a shout out, you need to email us at contact@crimesandconsequences.com. And please just let us know.
I think that's it.
I think that's
it. It's a lot of business.
I know. So thank you all for listening. And until next time.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.